Hey everybody, welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've got a very exciting topic today, a topic that's been in the news lately, given what's happening around the world, multiple crises that require aid to be shipped in to various locations around the world. We're going to be talking today about Web3 and international aid with Dr. Malin McKay, the founder of Qualipay. Welcome to the pod, Malin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you on. As always, just by way of introduction, I'm Paul, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans.
Well, guys, we're Pete here, the other founder of Literal Humans. Awesome to have you on the pod today, man.
We're going to be talking about the decentralized nature of blockchain technology, a technology that has the potential to transform international aid. So it's like a really exciting opportunity. The sector, as we know, it has been notoriously slow at adopting new technologies. And there's myriad issues, things like, you know, costs, lack of regulatory support, complexity, lack of trust, security concerns. Those are just a few of the things that jumped out to us. Malin, just curious to hear a bit about your perspective on just like the broader issue there, like the opportunity and the challenges that have plagued the sector.
Yeah, a short list of challenges, obviously. I think by way of a little bit of background, my training is in anthropology. I'm an anthropologist. I guess not a lot of people who would call themselves that, but I am an anthropologist. I'm not in the academy. I'm not a professor or anything like that, but did all of my training in anthropology. So that really informs my worldview and the way that I approach thinking about things and people and networks. And my work history has been almost entirely in the aid sector. I started in Burundi, which is where I've met some really amazing people, including a few folks on your team, I think, back in, 2011 or so, and worked at a small community-run health clinic that became much larger during the time that I was there, where I saw firsthand some of the difficulties that organizations like that face because they have community concerns in mind, and they still have to tap into funding that comes ultimately from a donor government. As much as we would like to say that the aid money that comes through those kinds of relationships is entirely based on need, a lot of the time it really is a reflection of sort of diplomatic soft power. So the pressure and the tension between those two things creates a situation where the best organizations that are doing good for their communities are really pressured to do good for donors. And those priorities might not be completely aligned. After Burundi, I ended up in South Sudan, saw the, you know, a country that looked like it was on the trajectory toward being, you know, not just a new country, but the world's newest democracy, become mired in civil conflict. And then ended up working on the Syrian conflict based in Beirut. And then actually focused during my doctoral research in Myanmar, which is a country that today is facing an enormous amount of conflict and strife. And I think that that is, in addition, quite indicative of some of the challenges with the way that the aid, you know, mechanisms work. Myanmar is not in the news. We have something like 2.6, 2.8 million people displaced, thousands of people dead. The military junta, which illegally deposed the democratically elected government, although it has not done a very good job of that, so they don't even have full control of the country and are losing ground every day. They're killing their own citizens, but not a lot of attention being paid to Myanmar by the general public. So hard to sort of see how aid flows are going to continue to reach that population despite really desperate need. All of this has been exacerbated by the fact that we operate in a context that was not built for us. Traditional financial infrastructure is not built for international aid. We're working cross-border, moving money into places that already had very limited financial infrastructure. One of the examples that I give a lot is that the entire time I was in South Sudan, there was not a functional ATM. So that makes it a really interesting context for Web3 because the common questions that you get asked, things like, well, how are you going to off-ramp from cryptocurrencies into fiat currencies? It's like, but there's not any fiat currency in a lot of these places anyway. We have a pilot that we're running in Sudan right now. But there's been a liquidity crisis for months. In some ways, in places where mobile technology has really leapfrogged financial technology, it's a great place where aid was already starting to sort of pilot a lot of mobile money type integrations. Now with Web3, we can do that in ways that hopefully don't then make us even more beholden to large companies, whether those are telecom providers or startups, fintechs, whatever you want to call them, but something that people can actually own and hold on to, and really importantly, take cross-border if they need to.
Yeah, I appreciated some of the challenges you highlighted there. In doing some of the research for this pod, we sort of looked at some examples of different alternatives, and one that came up, curious to get your opinion on it, is some of the work that's going on at Oxfam in terms of the unblocked cash project that they had. It sounds like they're touting it as a way to get, you know, more dignified and appropriate form of humanitarian assistance to folks in the form of, like, you know, cash and voucher assistance, particularly for folks who are unbanked. So how can you leverage blockchain to kind of, you know, increase support, you know, and this, like, form of financial assistance that's been hard to get to certain people. So they worked, you know, and they used the Ethereum token, DAI, and kind of wrapped, you know, a voucher in sort of crypto. According to the report that they put out, they said that it reduced recipient enrollment time to about 3 to 4 minutes, which used to take, I think, about an hour. And then it eliminated some of, like, the slow identity verification processes and dependency on, you mentioned ATMs, but in this case, post offices and banks to, you know, for folks to deposit checks and things like that. So I thought that was a really fascinating use of technology to, you know, speed, you know, assistance to folks, particularly those who are unbanked, but also remove some of the sort of red tape. Just curious to get your perspective on that.
First and foremost, I think I know some of the people who worked on that program, incredible team of people who've been doing a lot to bring a lot of blockchain know-how to lots of different organizations. That project is a great example of increasing financial access and the speed element. I think a lot of people don't really recognize how much of the aid process is analog. I think it is notable that the largest private companies in the aid sector, and that surprises a lot of people when I say there's a lot of private sector participants, but there are a lot of very big companies that work in the aid sector. And primarily what they're doing is managing aid funding. So let's say US government says we're going to put aside $75 million for education in Pakistan. That's not an easy thing to manage. And they're not going to be managing that directly themselves. They're probably going to put out a tender for a large organization, could be a big INGO, international non-governmental organization, but could also be a private company. The ASIs, Adam Smith International, Chemonix, big companies. Chemonix this year, I think, is a $2.6 billion company. And it's a consultancy, essentially. So I think that tells you where the value is being created. And unfortunately, the value is being created through inefficiency. And it's because you're taking expensive consultants and having them do things by hand. So not only do we lose enormous amounts of time and spend enormous amounts of money doing something just really inefficiently. And that's not to say these organizations aren't good organizations. They're doing the best they can, doing it by hand, but this is just not the best way to do it. So for example, the normal way that we would enroll participants into a cash transfer program or a voucher program, we'd first have to identify them. We might work with a local partner to do that. We would need to enroll them by hand. So, you know, reviewing their documentation, putting everything into an Excel spreadsheet, probably, maybe Google Docs, that's being kept by somebody who's probably a low-level data entry person who's didn't do any training in that and is probably being vastly, vastly underpaid for the amount of time it's about to take them to do it. And maintaining these lists for, and to give an example in the Myanmar context, we have a huge problem with the fact that the Myanmar alphabet, most international organizations don't bother learning Burmese. And so you have this problem with trying to transliterate the alphabet. No one uses the same spelling. Even people who are native Burmese speakers won't use the same alphabet. So imagine then you have an Excel spreadsheet with names. No one's names are spelled the way they might spell them. And then eventually, let's say you want to try to do something like a bank transfer. You now have this huge KYC issue because A, those people might not have documentation. Their documentation might not look the same as it does in your lists. And then on top of that, most traditional bank infrastructure is designed to use a first name and a last name. And Myanmar names don't follow that convention. So you send a transfer to someone. Let's say you get them through a KYC, despite the fact that, you know, their name doesn't look the same on their identity documents. And then you try to send them a bank transfer and it gets bounced back because the way that you've put that name into their form doesn't fit the way that they think it should work. Now you've just introduced like a 4-week delay in the process of trying to get somebody cash in the context of, let's say, a really active conflict. That's not just an inconvenience. That is life or death. And that is, I think, one of the reasons that programs like what Oxfam is running are so interesting to the aid sector, particularly cash and voucher type programs are really interesting to us for those reasons, because that traditional financial infrastructure is so lacking. What I will say is that at Koalapay, we focus a lot more on that sort of next level up of organization. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that we don't believe that vulnerability is something that is faced only by individuals. And so we don't believe that resilience is something that you can build only by focusing at the individual level. I think giving people money when they need money, especially cash transfers that don't come with limitations on what people can do with that cash. I think there's been a lot of progress made and a lot of recognition of the success of those programs in sort of alleviating immediate pain from shocks and stresses in economies or conflict, whatever it is. The problem is that long term, and we have the longitudinal data on this, we start to see diminishing returns because individuals are still facing the same contextual structural challenges that made them susceptible to those shocks and stressors in the first place.
What are those diminishing returns and how long does it take for them to sort of make themselves evident?
I think the latest study that I've seen, it's sort of 3 to 4 years. You start to see that the improvements in people's quality of life when they receive a direct transfer start to decrease. What we see if we compare to, say, giving funding to a community-based organization or like One Acre Fund, one of my favorite sort of smaller NGOs that do a lot of work in the community. So they're giving them training, they're supporting them with better seed quality, they're really walking hand in hand with the community, and they're really efficient in the way that they do it. If and when there's a problem with the crop, they have a place to go. And that makes a really big difference. They have an advocate who is tapped into funding flows, who knows how to identify problems, articulate them, seek funding, and then support with programming that's based off of community needs. That makes a big difference in how far a donation goes in terms of how many people benefit from it. So, you know, 3 to 4 years is where we start to see a major drop off in impact. That's not to say that those programs aren't important. They are important. Like most aid, there is never going to be a singular sort of solution to what is a very complex problem. The fact that aid money is moving to a place in the first place is already a sign that something has gone pretty terribly wrong. So the idea that there would be a singular solution, I think, would be really quite naive.
It's interesting. It strikes me that there's been like waves, obviously, in the international aid community. I worked in Kenya when I was in uni and Nairobi specifically, like for the Clinton Health Initiative. And there was the Mbisa Moyo crowd and things like that. And that the whole conversations about, you know, racism and paternalism and international aid programs. And there's been sort of ups and downs. And it's good to hear like a more discreet take, I think, on the giving and how, hey, like we can give directly and it does have a benefit up until a certain point. But then you have to solve things at like the community level. So then it makes more sense to give to, you know, community-based organizations. Then there's the whole sort of institutional level of like governments and like, you know, people can only do so much with the money you give them if their broader context isn't fixed.
There's a tendency in the aid sector to get attracted to the newest, latest, shiny thing. It's a trend in, let's say, like big consortiums I was talking about. It used to be that whoever the new consultancy was on the block, everyone would try to put them on their consortium bid because they knew that the donors wanted to see fresh thinking, innovation, all of that. But when you actually looked at what the innovation was, like there was a period where everyone did a dashboard. I mean, it was almost comical. If you looked at any single project, it was like, we did a data visualization dashboard. And that would win bids. I mean, it was so simple. But that, I think, A, speaks to your initial question of how little innovation there is in the sector. But B also speaks to longevity of these different interventions. And it's something we're thinking about a lot because we don't want to be the new kid on the block that is getting attention just because we're bringing something like a new idea. We really want to focus on what works. And I think very, very lucky that the people that I've been able to bring into this team are aid workers, first and foremost. They care about communities. And we're thinking a lot about what does it mean to really be in this for the long haul and to be an advocate for and a partner to communities rather than just a really great aid servicing company, because there's a lot of those and they come and go. And we want to make sure that we're setting the right foundations for sustainability.
Do you maybe want to walk us through exactly where KoalaPay sits in that sort of multi-tiered structure of different challenges that Paul flagged? And what your solution is for the problem to be a long-term sustainable partner for solving some of these structural issues?
We focus really intently on that smallest level of community organization for all the same reasons that a woman or a refugee might struggle to have access to a bank account. A woman-led organization or a refugee-led organization is going to struggle to participate in the aid economy. They don't have documentation. They maybe don't speak English as a first language. They maybe don't, you know, have access to a bank account. So how do you work with them as a partner in a community? But they might be the best placed to be a partner in the community because they're really closest to those needs and they're aware of what's happening, what's changing. So we focus on that level. We work with local organizations that normally have received some funding from an international organization. That could be an NGO or INGO. So they have some level of professionalization, some kind of formal structure. we take them through a due diligence process. We partner with a company to do a KYC. We sort of do that really closely hand in hand with them because of that documentation issue. So that allows us to KYC organizations that would otherwise never pass a bank KYC. And then we work with them to onboard them to our aid funding marketplace. Now, our aid funding marketplace makes it very easy for them to propose specific activities. So they say, for example, we need to buy solar panels for our health clinic because right now we are the only ones delivering healthcare to 5,000 people in our community. It's going to cost us about $5,000. They take that detail, drop it into a form, and then we transform that into a smart contract. The reason we do that is because sending money is one part of the problem. This is something you'll see a lot in the aid sector. What appears to be the problem when you first look at it is actually a much bigger problem deeper down. So it seems like the problem is that people just don't want to fund local organizations, that they want to keep paying their high-priced consultants. They want to keep their big international staffs. They want to do all that. I don't think that's actually the case. The case is that the amount of paperwork that goes into contracting in the aid sector is enormous. It's so enormous and it's non-standardized. So to get a local partner contracted to receive funding is, we're talking, it could be a year in terms of how long it takes. We're trying to streamline that process. So the smart contract itself functions as a contract for that aid activity. And the funding just happens to move through it. So the contract is actually a big part of what we're doing, is how do you make it so you can contract with these non-standard actors, get them the funding, but in a way that meets the compliance and due diligence requirements of the aid sector. The local partners are using self-custody wallets. We're in the process of trying to set them up with multi-signatory wallets. One of the challenges there is that anytime you do a transaction on blockchain, you have costs because of gas fees. So we're working on basically establishing a gas station so that a third party can pay for those transactions to happen. So the local partners aren't losing funds due to gas fees. That's a big problem with blockchain adoption in these parts of the world. We do a lot of hands-on education, and we're in the process now of launching a fully remote third-party monitoring and evaluation tool that actually sits at the community level, works with the local partners. So not only can we evaluate their programs without disrupting their work and without disrupting the community experience, I think it's a real problem in our sector that we embed monitoring and evaluation expectations on local partners without really increasing the funding we give them. But at the same time, we need to know how that funding is being used and the impact it's having. So we're trying to break that out into its own sort of separate process, but make it happen in a way that is much less disruptive to communities that are experiencing crisis.
And we've sort of like jumped right into it, but wanted to take a step back and talk a little bit, you know, just about Qualipay more broadly, and also just mention, you know, for our listeners, some of the interesting bits about you, Dr. McKay. You did your doctoral work at Oxford. You've worked in conflict affected contexts, such as, you mentioned South Sudan, you mentioned Myanmar, you mentioned, I don't think you mentioned Libya, but that's another one. You got some initial funding from Coinbase. That's a name that some of our listeners might know. You got some VC funding from MasterCard's Start Path program, but just curious to hear a bit more about how that all led to Qualipay, and specifically how it differs from other blockchain-based aid interventions at places like the World Food Program, UNHCR, CARE, and just, you know, more to that question of where Qualipay sits in the tech and international aid subsector.
I am not somebody who I would consider, like, that anyone would consider techie in any way, shape, or form. I was in Myanmar. I was advising an EU program, and I've been working on Myanmar since 2015. And we couldn't pay anybody. The military did what militaries often do, or let's just say, you know, autocratic governments often do when they want to start oppressing their own people. They control the financial system. People were having any foreign currency they were holding in their bank accounts just lifted out of it. I have, you know, friends who had tens of thousands of dollars in their accounts that were just gone overnight. And they start to manipulate the foreign exchange rate. So any dollar that's coming into the country, of course, they're saying it's worth this much of the local currency, but really it's worth more on the black market. That differential is going entirely into their pockets. That's exactly how the aid sector lost $100 million to Assad during the Syrian civil war. That same thing is happening in a lot of places. Local partners didn't want to receive funding into their bank accounts. The military put limitations on how much you could take out. They were also observing who was getting foreign bank transactions. And we know that they were targeting women's organizations. They were, you know, lots of local aid actors were really affected by that. So they started saying, look, we don't want to receive any money from our bank accounts. At the same time, as governments passed targeted sanctions, a lot of fintech organizations like Wise and others just said, look, we're not going to play at all. So that it got to the point where even if you had somebody on your team who had a Burmese passport, you might lose access to your Wise account. Suddenly, all the different channels for getting money into the country were becoming more and more constrained at a time when we had more need than ever. I think in that same year, the people in need number went from 8 million to 14 million, basically overnight. Nobody could get money in. I was just trying to solve that problem. That was, you know, it was a very acute, very personal issue. And I was very lucky that I happened to know some people who were in the Web3 space. So when I started talking to people about this problem I was having, and people would say, oh, that's interesting. You could kind of, what about crypto? At first, I was really, really resistant, but it just kept coming up. And then finally, I had a conversation with a friend of mine in Myanmar who said, oh yeah, well, we've been making these transactions through Binance peer-to-peer. So I sat down with a man who is now my co-founder, Adam Dakata, who at the time was the head of partnerships for Decentraland, and said, look, I don't know what I don't know. I don't know anything about this, but it keeps coming up. So could you tell me what this is? And what really clicked for me was when he started talking about smart contracts, because again, I knew that getting the money to move is one problem, but the much deeper problem is the contractual compliance piece. Got excited about that. And then he said, well, there's this guy you've got to meet who can build it. And that's how I met my other co-founder, Roy, who is an incredible, incredible blockchain engineer, has built his own layer too. I mean, he's so brilliant. And I'm so lucky that when I came to him and said, here's this problem that we have in the aid sector, he said, I don't know anything about the aid sector, but that seems like a really interesting real world use case. And we need more of those. So we all came together and wrote a proposal for Coinbase Giving and ended up getting some funding initially to start playing around with our idea. And then we went on to raise our, we just closed our pre-seed round, just under $1 million, actually. Very, very lucky that we were able to do that. And one of the worst times for fundraising, and especially as a first time and a female founder, that was a big concern. We're very lucky. We have some incredible partners who've come in on that Lattice Fund and Factor. We are now in the process of rolling out pilots in a couple of different countries, Bhutan, Sudan, Myanmar. We've completed our first pilot there. So we've been able to demonstrate end-to-end payments into the communities with local partners. And we're about to go into Kenya and a few other countries, including Somalia. So seeing a lot of geographic spread. And I think the reason for that is because our approach is a little different from some of the NGO or UN-led projects. It's very, very difficult if you build something inside an NGO or a UN agency to share it. There is a lot of competition for programs for funding, and it makes it very, very difficult to achieve collaboration when, and people try so hard, and there's a lot of really goodwill. It's a structural problem. We very intentionally decided we didn't want to be an NGO for exactly that reason, because we want to be able to work with everybody. Because for us, network effect makes the tool more valuable for everybody. And for the local partners, the more donors that are on the platform, the better, because the more access they have to potential streams of funding. So for us, we wanted to be, let's say, donor agnostic, country agnostic. We want to be able to work with anyone, anywhere.
Do you see yourself as competing against inefficient processes or inefficient aid delivery processes, scams? Or maybe even, you know, bad actors, you know, who are sort of wolves in sheep's clothing, as it were, in the aid sector?
I really like the saying that sort of like, don't attribute malice to that which can be attributed to incompetence. I don't think there's a lot of like bad actors in the aid sector. There for sure are a couple of total weirdos, but they tend to out themselves pretty quickly. And there is certainly a white saviorism that I think is very unhelpful and I think causes a lot of problems. That said, I think there's also classism that causes a lot of problems. There's a tendency to, you know, take somebody from urban educated population in, you know, let's say Sudan, and make them now the representative of all Sudanese, even if they've never worked or lived in some of these areas that are actually being most affected by conflict. So there's a lot of layers to the sort of paternalism that goes into giving people money. And one of the things that we say is that we want international aid to feel more like mutual aid. And I think that is where Web3 is really, you know, as an ethos, is really important, because the idea of decentralization, of being able to connect people from very different places. Why is it that when you want to give after an earthquake in Nepal, you end up giving to an, you know, international organization instead of to a local Nepalese group? You don't know who they are. You don't know if you can trust them. Those are some of the big roadblocks. But people want to. They want to be able to do that. So I would say we don't see that we're competing against other organizations necessarily. I think any organization in the aid sector could benefit from working with us. Like, we could go to those big consultancies and decrease their overheads. That's only good for everybody. Like, I remember when I first started talking about what we were doing to a friend of mine who's been in humanitarian aid as long as I have, and we, you know, we've known each other for years. And he said, "Are you telling me that you could automate the worst part of my job?" I was like, "Yes, that's exactly what we could do." So I don't see us competing in that way. I think we are collaborating. We want to collaborate. What I think we are doing, where it is a little bit of a, you know, pushing the envelope kind of thing, is that we do really want people to start thinking about the idea that why is it that your giving to other, you know, people in other places is mediated through a government that has policy perspectives and potentially does things that you don't agree with in terms of how they situate themselves vis-a-vis a specific conflict.
I guess I'm curious, like, what exit looks like for Koalapay. So if it's not getting adopted by these governments or IGOs, which are trying to sidestep in many ways, but you also don't want to become one of the bloated, you know, NGOs that you're sort of bemoaning here. So like, what is the end game for Koalapay?
We see a lot of synergy with large telecom, for example, like ICT companies. We've seen some great acquisitions in that space. The Giving Block, I think, joined Shift4. That was a great acquisition for everyone involved. I think it's, you know, added a lot of capability because, for instance, one of the big struggles we have is that off-ramp piece. We are about to integrate essentially the ability to off-ramp to any Western Union or MoneyGram location, which is going to be huge. But in a lot of these conflict places, that even the Western Unions are affected by conflict. So having the opportunity to move to mobile money is going to be pretty important. So I think that's where you can see some of those opportunities. We also have a large data component to our business. So again, that's where some of that, I think, makes sense. That said, I don't know that it's even going to be possible for us to identify who the big and most interesting players are that come out of this next bull run. There are going to be new faces or old faces with, you know, slightly new approaches. So we're just excited to see what that brings and look where those partnerships are. I mean, I could see us, you know, going in-house with a large exchange, for example. We've been really, really excited by how collaborative people have been and how willing people are to just take a chance. You know, I never would have expected, you know, getting texts saying, "Hey, we can't fund our local partners. We heard you're working on this." And you're like, "Yeah, we are. It's going to be out there. Are you willing to go on a little bit of an adventure with us?" And they're like, "Yeah, let's do it," because the problem is so acute. Really excited to see what the next couple of years look like for us. We're starting to play around with Oracle integrations. So we're going to be working on a pilot in Somalia where we actually link the distribution of funds to weather conditions. So a little bit like parametric insurance, but the goal there is to eventually be able to work with other kinds of data. So maybe it's protection data or conflict data, so that we're actually able to almost anticipate where money needs to go, you know, minutes after. Our average payments to local partners settle in about 2 minutes. So imagine the power of tying those distributions to weather events. There's an earthquake, and within an hour, money is exactly with the people who are best placed to support the communities in need. It's a very powerful tool, and we're excited to start bringing that out to more and more people.
How have you found those conversations with different folk within the tech sector? And it's interesting as well for you. I mean, like that Oracle, such a classic, players of the tech sector, massive. And then obviously all the Web3 and crypto exchanges that you deal with on a daily basis that are far more kind of new money tech sector. And how have those conversations gone where, you know, you're coming at this from very much the heart and soul of a nonprofit and they have sort of profit motives? Is there any conflict there, any tension, any worries about how that plays out further down the line?
I would say that the most fun thing and the simultaneously most sad thing when we're working with the Web3 folks is that I always feel like I'm the bearer of bad news when I start explaining to them all the things that don't work in the aid sector. And you can watch people sort of become crestfallen in real time because they thought that they were doing a really good job by making a regular donation to this or that organization. But I have to say, one of the things that's so lovely about working with Web3 folks is that spirit of optimism. There is a sense in the sector that, you know, we're all in this together and we're going to make it work and it's going to happen. And maybe you can call it slightly delusional, but you have to be when it's new technology. And so that has been like a surprisingly fun thing, bringing people in, helping them to understand the challenges that we're facing and starting to find solutions with them together. The flip side of that is that the aid sector is also quite open, but it just takes them a little bit longer to understand the technology. And the thing is, you can't really do the traditional build an MVP and then iterate. thing with the aid sector. You kind of have to have a product that works before anyone's going to try it, because you can't mess around with taxpayer money. So that has required a lot of education for the Web3 folks. That makes it sometimes a hard pitch, because when they're like, you got to get your pitch down to 2 minutes to raise funding, it's like, look, we're not for you then, because I guarantee you that there is so much you don't know about the sector that I can't even get you the context you need to be able to understand why this is going to be so transformative without a much longer time. It took us a while to find those right partners. Our first, large investment came through a great angel network here in the Bay Area. And then we raised also from CVVC in Switzerland, who also were looking specifically for real world use cases. Long story short, it's a process of finding the right partners. It's of finding the people that get it and who are interested and excited about trying to bite into something that is a big and complex puzzle. At the same time, the reality is that, like I said, there are private sector companies working in the aid sector. There's a lot of them. And there are reasons why you would choose that form over an NGO form. And that is because it allows you more flexibility, it lets you move a lot more quickly, and it allows you to tap into these different pockets of funding. So for example, we are in the process of exploring whether it might be interesting to add a really easy API for some of the different Web3 ecosystems that allows projects in those ecosystems to add a give to Qualipay function, kind of like a roundup at purchase type thing. So, you know, let's say anytime you wanted to buy an NFT, it says, do you want to round up, add 1% to your fees to go to? And then you'd actually be able to allocate exactly where you want that funding to go. And because it's linked to your wallet, we can track exactly how much impact you've had over time. And then we can link that into all kinds of other things. So if you make a purchase and you've got a wallet online, and we can give you automatically a 10% discount because you have good karma. You know what I mean? There's lots of different cool integrations that you can do. And that allows us to tap into that side of the, you know, funding ecosystem or of the money ecosystem that maybe moves a bit more quickly, and where it's okay to have more of a profit incentive while still maintaining our core business, which is making aid work better just for everybody.
Yeah, that's a really cool innovation you mentioned, like being able to enumerate the impact that someone's had. That's one of the, you know, like you said, there's optimism in the space. That's one of the exciting bits of blockchain and Web3 is like, hey, we can track this stuff now and make people... like what can we unlock if we make people feel better, feel good about the, you know, the contributions they're making and really understand their impact in a real way? I think that's really exciting.
That's where GiveDirectly has done such a great job, because you feel like, okay, I'm giving money to this person. I can see what this person is doing. It's that idea of that direct connection, that feeling of mutual aid, not international aid. It's all of that kind of wrapped into the ease of it not needing to be that you give to one organization, right? So of course, GiveDirectly has had, I mean, great organization, but they've had some significant scandals in Congo and other places. You don't want to be too dependent on a single actor. And so the goal of the decentralization of our platform is that you can, you know, we're a discovery tool, but you can go directly to any of these organizations. You can just find them and fund them. And once that's established, then you have that relationship and you can build on that with them directly, because no one actor is going to have the best answer to these very complex problems.
I appreciate that. And I'm glad you touched on like the importance of getting it right, you know, as much as possible the first time. This idea of like experimenting with blockchain and vulnerable communities can potentially put them at further risk. I'm glad you flagged that. We were talking about Oxfam's blocked cash program earlier, and you know, they had some criticism, and there was a report from the Minderoo, I'm not sure how to say that, Center for Technology and Democracy at the University of Cambridge, that mentioned that that program in particular enabled blockchain companies like Consensus to kind of develop their products in circumstances of limited accountability and limited tax, to quote the Minderoo Center. And also the challenge of people not having technical knowledge or digital literacy to access some of these solutions. I think that's really interesting. And the ways that like experimenting in these contexts can kind of amplify risk. So curious to hear your perspective about someone who's like tried to avoid that as a startup founder, and what you put in place and what you'd recommend other startup founders in the Web3 and international aid space put in place to make sure that you're as close as possible getting it right the first time and responsibly deploying this technology in these international aid contexts.
I guess first and foremost, the aid sector is highly critical, and to a point sometimes that I think can be really unproductive. A bit of it is territorial behavior. There's a lot of gatekeeping. And it's much easier to critique something than it is to design and develop some things. That's not to say there aren't valid criticisms. It's just to sort of say sometimes a criticism is a little harder than it probably needs to be. And that can be why that there are so many vested interests in the aid sector that it's really good to remember that even the critics probably have something that you should be paying attention to as to why they might come really hard at something. Part of the reason why we have decided to work through local partners is because we feel that we are never going to know enough about every single community to be able to determine what is the correct level of risk versus reward. But local partners can, and they're the ones who are on the ground. They live in these communities. They're the ones that know what's going on. So for example, our data collection tool, we're going to work with the local partners to onboard users. We're not going to onboard users directly. And the reason for that is because there are contexts in the world where data collection itself is risky, Myanmar being one of those places. We are not going to go out and individually try to sign people up when there's the risk that maybe we don't understand enough about the contextual risks. The local partners will. So if we go to a local partner and say, reward you by giving you the ability to request larger amounts of funding for each set of people that you onboard to this tool, if they say that's not worth the risk, then they won't bring people onto the tool. So we put local partners, local organizations really in the driver's seat and a lot of the decisions we make about what to do and where. And I think that's just the way we've decided to approach that problem. It makes us feel a lot more comfortable because it means that we have partners who really know the context, who can advise us on what they think is safe and what's not.
Yeah, it's a fascinating perspective. We worked with Chipper Cash a little, who are a sort of like a TransferWise, but for the African continent. And they were like, yeah, this is like some of the highest crypto adoption in the world are in many of these countries. So actually, you know, they're ahead of a lot of Western countries in terms of knowledge of Web3 and crypto. But there is that very paternalistic view of like, oh, well, you know, this is beyond the scope of the aid organizations.
If I were an investor, I would be investing in African businesses first and foremost. African fintechs, I think, are some of the most interesting businesses. And what's so exciting about them is that what they're working out now, the models they're developing, are built for these kinds of economies that exist all over the place. And like, they are going to be so much better as businesses in these other places in the world than like something that's incubated here in Silicon Valley is going to be going out into those environments. So I would put my money on African businesses competing and out-competing a lot of quote-unquote Western companies in the very near future.
Always love to end the pod on a prediction. So yeah, I think
I'm glad to hear that. It's the highlight of my year every time I get to go work from Kenya, because it's just the entrepreneurs there are first class and really working on real world problems. They're dealing with things like legislation and lack of rule of law in places that we have too, but we just don't see them. They're figuring these things out, I think, much more quickly than we will. So there's a lot to learn from those businesses and those leaders.
We have this conversation a lot with folk on the pod, is like, it's cool when you see tech actually trying to solve real problems. I don't need 10 different ways to get McDonald's to my door in like 5 minutes quicker. Whereas, yeah, how do you actually make sure that people get access to money when they need it based on world events outside of their control? Like, yeah, that's a real problem. Solve that. So yeah. It's awesome to see you taking that mantle on.
This is something that I say a lot, but if you happen to be in one of the few places in the world where your financial infrastructure works for you, then congratulations, you probably don't need Web3. That is a tiny slice of the world. And it does not mean that you get to be dismissive of the number of human rights defenders, of activists, of people around the world that are looking to this technology because their governments are stripping away their rights, they're taking away their money. I mean, great for all the people in the world that don't need to have more control over their finances because they can trust the banks and they can trust their governments. But that is not the experience of a lot of people in the world. And I think importantly, no one should take for granted that that will be their experience forever. Situations can change. And having sovereign control over your own money is not a bad thing to have.
Amazing. And for our listeners who might be interested in getting involved in Kuala Pay, where can they check you out? Where can they follow you online and kind of stay abreast of all the cool stuff you're up to?
Yeah, follow us on Twitter, X. We're also on LinkedIn. That's, you know, where a lot of the aid chat happens. Kuala Pay is with a C, which confuses people, but it's a bit of a take on being a crypto hawala. The aid sector uses a lot of these informal cash transfer agents called hawalas. So when we first started talking about what we were doing, somebody said, oh, it's like a crypto hawala, it's a koala. And we were like, oh, that's going to stick. But find us there. We do have an intake form on our website. So if you want to get involved and, you know, if you're a Web3 company and you want to add a way for your users to do really frictionless social impact giving, send us a note. We'd love to work with you. If you're a business and you want to do better social impact and you like the idea of being able to give directly to local aid programs, and actually fund an activity versus just giving into a pot of money and like crossing your fingers that people are using it wisely. Get in touch. We'd love to work with you. Anyone who is hearing this from the NGO space or the donor space, also reach out because we'd love to make your giving more impactful.
Well, put us down as one of those companies that's interested, and we can chat more about that definitely, because we're always thinking about how we can be a better, more ethical business. We're considering going for B Corp this year, and this would fall squarely into, I think, some of the initiatives we're looking to roll out and square up in terms of our journey as an ethical agency. So this has been a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation. Dr. Malin McKay, founder of Koala Pay, thank you so much for your time. It's been awesome, for me to jump back into a space I used to work in. And just really cool to hear about the new innovations happening and the great work you're doing.
Thanks so much for having me and giving me the chance to chat through a very complicated topic, but one that we hope will get more people excited about Web3.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.